rushing to the window and flinging open the casement. He plainly saw his friend on a wild steed. He called after him, but without another word he galloped out of sight. Thereupon he sent immediately to Florence to inquire concerning his friend's health, and learned that he died about that hour he called to him. Mrs. Crowe tells of an Edinburgh citizen who, riding gently up Gorstorphine Hill one day, observed an intimate friend of his own, on horseback also, immediately behind him. He slackened his pace to give him time to come up, but presently was amazed to find no one in sight, although there was no side road by which his friend could have departed. Perplexed in mind at the strange circumstance, he returned home to find that during his absence his friend had been killed by his horse falling in Candlemaker's Row. Again, a Yorkshire farmer's wife, away from home, was suddenly seen to ride into the farmyard on horseback and then disappear, and she was afterward found to have died at that precise time. One day, before Miranda Eddy's death, the family were sitting at dinner, when suddenly a heavy bell tolled one, in the air, right over their heads, and the reverberations of the peal died away while they listened for the stroke to be repeated. Miranda saw James and Francis in the spirit and gave orders for her own tombstone. She ordered the inscription, "Not dead but risen. Why seek ye the living among the dead?" to be placed upon it. The survivors declare that she was the greatest medium in the whole family. An old woman of the neighborhood, who has the same passion for laying out corpses that a famous New York thief, nicknamed the Chief Mourner, had for attending funerals, was counting upon the pleasant job Miranda was soon to furnish her, but the dying girl said the miserable creature should never close her eyes. She made her mother promise that no one but she should touch her body, and then calmly awaited the end. As the ebb of life interfered with her breathing, Mrs. Stephen Baird, a friendly neighbor, supported her in her arms. The last minute arrived, the wrist was pulseless, and the last gasp was being taken, when the dead right arm raised itself, and the dead hand closed the glazed eyes. Here is Mrs. Baird's own certificate, Chittenden, October 5, 1874. I certify that I was present on the occasion of Miranda Eddy's death, that I held her up at the last moment, and that, just at her last gasp, her arm rose and her right hand closed her eyes. Mary Baird. Miranda wrote her own obituary verses, which, at the family's request, I quote, "There's a silence in parlor and chamber, there's a sadness in every room, though we note he was the father who claimed her, yet everything is burdened with gloom. But we will not be comfortless mourners, for we know where the angels have borne her, and soon we shall see her again." Francis Lightfoot Eddy was orderly sergeant of Company G, 5th Vermont Volunteers, in the late war. He contracted a heavy cold in the army that soon ran into quick consumption, and the poor fellow came home to die. He lay sick 3 months, but 3 days before the end approached, he wrote in the family Bible, the exact day and hour of his death. A fortnight previous to this, the family heard a wagon drive up to the front door. One evening, the latch lifted and the button turned, and they saw two soldiers bring in a coffin and place it in the entry, and then retire and drive off without saying a word. On the coffin was a plate with a name upon it, which not being able to read in the obscurity, they went for a candle, but upon its being brought, the coffin had vanished like its mysterious bearers. When Francis died they sent to Rutland by a neighbor for his coffin, and when that was brought, it was the counterpart of its spectral double, to the very plate and nails. Francis also dictated the style of his tombstone and wished it to bear the inscription, "Passed into the world of spirits," instead of the usual formula, "Died." He also wanted a flag carved on the stone, surmounted by the legend, "Freedom at last." But old Mr. Eddy was bound to have his own way in this as in everything else, and set up a stone to suit himself. This enraged the boy's spirit so much that he came back in materialized and unmaterialized form, and annoyed them until they replaced the obnoxious marble with one according with his dying request. In the spring of 1863 the child of Sophia Eddy, wife of Sylvester Chase, of Bennington, VT, lay sick at the old Eddy homestead, of lung fever. Her death was expected by all, and Delia ironed a white dress and skirt for the little girl and laid them away in the mother's trunk. One evening Horatio went out to the penstock for water, and, looking up, he saw his own room in the second story lighted up and two strange old women walking about, shaking the invalid's dresses and busying themselves in other preparations, apparently for the coming death. He ran upstairs, and, opening his door, found a table set in the middle of the floor, covered with a sheet taken from the bed and on it the child's clothes, which had been removed from the trunk in another room. The smoking wicks of two candles showed the source of the light he had observed. Knowing by experience what this sort of thin comma meant, he came down and told the watchers that the child would die. The mother at once fell into a violent convulsion, which ended in a dead faint. Meanwhile Horatio had gone to the door and stood watching the relighting of the candles and the moving about of the ghostly women, when, just as Mrs. Chase had fainted, the light was extinguished. There was a rush of invisible feet down tile stairs and into the chamber, and the child soon began to mend in the arms of William, who tended the little one with affectionate care. They were afterwards told that it was fully expected that she would die, and spirit friends had gathered there to receive her. But the mother's alarming condition induced them to unite their efforts to keep alive the flickering spark of life. Now, please bear in mind that all these portents have had their prototypes in various countries at various times. The books are full of them, and unless we choose to reject corroborative testimony of a character and to a degree that would substantiate any other facts in any court of justice, we have no right to whistle these psychological phenomena down the wind. If they have occurred more frequently than might be wished in the presence of illiterate and plain people who were incapacitated to observe and study them to the best advantage, it is only the louder call upon men of science to take up the inquiry and set our minds at rest. Says Mr. Crookes in the Quarterly Journal of Science for July, 1871, it argues ill for the boasted freedom of opinion among scientific men, that they have so long refused to institute a scientific investigation into the existence and nature of facts asserted by so many competent and credible witnesses, and which they are freely invited to examine when and where they please. For my own part, I too much value the pursuit of truth, and the discovery of any new fact in nature, to avoid inquiry because it appears to clash with prevailing opinions. These are nobler words, and worthy of consideration by every scientist who would not be considered an obstructionist in this time of progress. He adds in the same article, I confess I am surprised and pained at the timidity or apathy shown by scientific men in reference to this subject. Some little time ago, when an opportunity for examination was first presented to me, I invited the cooperation of some scientific friends in a systematic investigation. But I soon found that to obtain a scientific committee for the investigation of this class of facts was out of the question, and that I must be content to rely on my own endeavors, aided by the cooperation from time to time of a few scientific and learned friends who were willing to join in the inquiry. When Mr. Crookes announced in 1870 his intention to take up this new branch of scientific inquiry, his determination was applauded by the most influential journals in Europe. Now, they said, we shall have the facts, for now a truly great student of nature is set about finding it all out. But when he found it out and announced, like the honest and brave man he is, that his researches warranted the belief that spiritual intercourse was a demonstrable truth, he was abused and vilified to such a degree as to make it apparent that what he was expected to discover was something that would not run counter to popular prejudice. I have said that the eddy portents have their prototypes. The frequency of this class of phenomena led the German psychologists to adopt the doctrine of guardian spirits, a doctrine, says Mrs. Crowe, which has prevailed more or less in all ages, and has been considered by many theologians to be supported by the Bible. The literal accuracy of the sketch of the phantom carriage has been endorsed on three separate occasions since its appearance in the Daily Graphic, by what claimed to be spirits, who addressed me in audible voice, one of the three Mrs. Eddy herself, and all three assert that the apparition was sent by a guardian spirit. I know the full value of words, and I mean to say unequivocally that a woman, a breathing, walking, palpable woman, as palpable as any other woman in the room, recognized not only by her sons and daughters, but also by neighbors present, as Mrs. Zephaniah Eddy, deceased December 29, 1872 on the evening of October 2, 1874, walked out of a cabinet where there was only one mortal, and where, under ascertained circumstances, only this one man could have been at the time, and spoke to me personally in audible voice, and 19 other persons saw her at the same time, and heard her discourse. The records teem with instances of warnings being conveyed by supernatural agency, to persons in temporary danger, as well as to those about to die. Among the most interesting is that of the white-robed child Emmanuel, who attended Frau Jung Stilling from 1799 to her death. He would forewarn her of dangers, attended her when traveling, and hovered near at all times and seasons. He addressed her in a language of his own, which, though unintelligible to others, she somehow understood. When she asked the spirit to show himself to her husband, he refused, alleging that to do so would make him ill and cause his death. Few persons, he explained, are able to see such things. After the death of Dante, it was discovered that the 13th canto of the Paradiso was missing, and all search for it proved unavailing. But after some months the dead poet appeared to his son Pietro Aliari, and told him that if he removed a certain panel near the window of the room in which the poem was written, the missing canto would be found. And it was found, much mildewed but legible. The story I told of Horatio Eddy's finding his grandmother's snuffbox and gold necklace, has its counterpart in the case of Madame von Militz, related by Mrs. Crow, who, being about to sell her ancestral home, was instructed by a voice to go to the cellar and open a certain part of the wall. She did so, and found a goblet in which was a small gold ring, on which was engraven the name Anna von Militz. A Scotch gentleman, who was passing the night in the manse of Strashaw, Argyll, was visited during the night by an apparition, which said, "I come to tell you that this day 12 months you will be with your father." By a most curious concatenation of circumstances, he lost his life at the very time indicated, in a storm. I have mentioned the appearance of James Eddy to his brother William at the moment of his death, and if I had space, could cite 20 similar cases from familiar authors. One will suffice for the present. Lord Balcarres was confined in the castle of Edinburgh on a charge of Jacobitism, and one night, saw his friend Viscount Dundee open the curtains of his bed and look in upon him, and then walk to the mantelpiece, lean upon it a moment, and go out of the room. At the same hour, as it subsequently appeared, the Viscount had died. When it is known that William Eddy never had a month's schooling in his life, and that he is almost illiterate, it will readily be imagined that he never even heard of Lord Balcarres. The curious weapon of which the artist has furnished a sketch was dug out of the ground, from a depth of 4 feet below the surface, by Horatio Eddy, near Batavia, N.Y., where he happened to be exhibiting, some years ago. His information as to its locality, was obtained, he says, from a spirit. The shape of the weapon, and the quaint ornamentation of the bronze handle, will interest the antiquary. The sketch of the spinning ghost tells the story of a curious family experience, attested to me by every member of the Eddy connection that I have seen. After old Mrs. McComb's death, she was for years in the habit of returning to the north room on the second floor and turning her spinning wheel. 4 of the boys slept there, and the wheel stood in the southeast corner, behind the door. The children were greatly frightened at first to hear the buzz and see no one, but they soon grew familiar with the thing, and finally, to be sure that grandmother would awaken them, they hung a little bell on the wheel. The phenomenon, which had frightened them at first so that they hid their little faces beneath the bed covering, had become a nightly diversion. After a while the spirit materialized herself, feebly at first but stronger by degrees, until she would come looking exactly as when alive. The sketch represents the scene with absolute accuracy, and it is worthwhile to call attention to the fact that, except for the title, no one would suspect that the woman was not of this world. It was intended that it should be just so, for I can assure the reader, that, so far from the materialized spirits who appear in the Eddy It Circle room seeming ghost-like, They are as substantial in every respect as any of us who gaze at the weird phalanx of the dead alive, a chapter of feet and inches. Assume it to be a fundamental principle that, in making scientific researches, results must be self-sufficient, requiring neither excuse nor charity of construction, but carrying conviction in themselves. To deserve admission into the field of science, they must be arrived at under circumstances that absolutely exclude the chance of error. They must, moreover, be capable of reproduction at any time, under exactly the same circumstances, by any capable scientist, in any part of the world. I admit, also, that in view of the multitudinous liabilities to self-deception by trusting to the senses, their evidence should be largely excluded. To think I see a body rise in opposition to the law of gravity, as now understood, is to the student of science no evidence that I did see the phenomenon. He says that it is more reasonable to believe my eyesight at fault, or that, if I did see the body rise, trickery was involved, than that the universal law of gravity was disturbed in this particular instance. But if the lifting of the weight can be indicated on an instrument, which having neither eyes nor psychological idiosyncrasies, cannot be deceived, then a new fact is gained for science, and our whole domain of knowledge has to be remeasured. Applying these rules to my own case, in what attitude do I stand towards the scientific world? The answer is readily given. The collector of a few facts and observer of certain phenomena, which others must classify and analyze, the gatherer of a few of the pebbles on the strand, gazing over the whole ocean that lies there, inviting the keel of the bold and skillful navigator, but which I cannot explore. As William Morton, the common sailor, pushing ahead of his companions, looked out upon the open polar sea that had been the dream of geographical science for ages, and, humble as he was, pointed the way for all future Arctic explorers, so, I trust, that in reporting what is to be seen at the Vermont House of Wonders, this outpost upon the borders of the world known, and gateway of the world unknown, I may at least lighten the labors of those more learned and scientific than I, who are to come this way with the clue of the labyrinth in their hands, if I am so fortunate as to observe any one thing so carefully that it commands the thoughtful attention of one trained investigator, and so ultimately leads to the discovery of an occult force, I should be most thankful, while if I should discover, or assist others to prove the Eddy Marvels to be nothing but chicane, the public will be the gainer and I shall deserve well of it. I am led to make these remarks, by various criticisms and suggestions received by me from sources worthy of respect. It is proper that I should define my position, beyond mistake, and declare that, if I misrepresent what I see, hear, and feel, it will be through lack of trained powers of observation, and the consequent deception of my senses, and no other cause. Of course there is danger of this very thing, for I am not capable of doing the work of the man of science, any more than that of the dentist or cabinet maker. But perhaps I am as competent as the average of laymen, and so we will let it pass at that. There were one or two pseudo-investigators at the Eddies during my visit, skipping in for a day or so, and skipping off again, ready to avow that all of William's materialized spirits were William in disguise, and all of Horatio's surprising manifestations, the easy tricks of a traveling conjurer. If one tells them of babies being carried in from the cabinet by women, of young girls with lithe forms, yellow hair, and short stature, of old women and the men standing in full sight and speaking to us, of half-grown children seen, two at a time, simultaneously with another form, of costumes of different makes, of bald beads, grey hair, black, shocky heads of hair, curly hair, of dash hosts instantly recognized by friends and ghosts speaking audibly in a foreign language of which the medium is ignorant, their equanimity is not disturbed for an instant. One sound and sufficient rule is applied: exclude everything troublesome, and explain away the rest as fraud. Let the world wag as it will, they are omniscient and infallible, and, with Sir Oracle, say, when I open my mouth, let no log bark. The credulity of some scientific men, too, is bound lest they would rather believe that a baby could lift a mountain without levers, than that a spirit could lift an ounce. Alfred Wallace, of London, told a friend of mine that if a new fact were presented to Tyndall he would smell it, Look at it, taste it, turn it over, handle it, bite it, and then wouldn't believe. This is an extreme illustration of scientific skepticism, but after all, it fairly illustrates the habit which, properly moderated, protects the world from false teaching. At the same time, it must be admitted that this spirit clogs the wheels of progress and obliges discoverers to win their just renown at the price of suffering and persecution. The other day, a visitor at the Eds offered to bet me $1,000 to $100 that he could personate every one of the ghosts he saw that night, with a few dollars worth of stage properties, and do every trick of Horatio's light circle after a day's preparation. All I could say was that in such case he need not hunt for gold mines, for he had one in his head and fingers. The phenomena publicly exhibited at the Eddie Homestead are of the following character: 1. The so-called materialization of spirit forms, which occur in a circle room in the second story of the apart of the house. 2. The showing of materialized hands, the ring test, writing of names of deceased persons upon cards, by detached hands, and playing on instruments in the light, which usually happen in a circle held at the conclusion of the materialization circle. 3. The playing of musical instruments, voices, the sound of heavy dancing, the moving of ponderous bodies, the floating of musical instruments through the air, the noise of struggles and sword combats between two combatants, the flashing of phosphorescent lights, the touching and patting of our persons by supposed spirit hands, a concert of musical instruments, numerous enough to require the aid of at least 4 performers, solo playing on the harmonicon, accordion, violin, flute, guitar, or concertina, the improvisation of rhymes by a voice, upon a subject named by any person present, whistling, the imitation of a storm at sea, with the whistling and roaring of the gale, the force of waves, the sucking pumps, these in a totally darkened room. All these forms of manifestation I have seen, heard, or felt, and each many times. My first problem was whether the manifestations were produced with the help of confederates, and I will state the physical conditions surrounding the performers. The room is, as I observed, in a new extension, or L. Its windows are 13 feet 9 inches from the ground. No ladder is owned on the premises. For the use of carpenters engaged in making some small repairs, one was borrowed in the neighborhood. There is but one door of entrance, and this at the end of the room next to the main part of the house. The room is 37 feet 6 inches long and 17 feet wide, with a ceiling 9 feet 2 inches high in the center, and 6 feet 11 inches at the sides. At the farther or west end is the kitchen chimney, 2 feet 7 inches by 3 feet 4 inches, in the center of the gable. To the right of the chimney is a closet of the same depth, 2 feet 7 inches and a length of 7 feet, with a window in it, 2 feet 6 inches from the floor, and having a 2 feet 2 inch by 2 feet 3 inch opening. The door to the closet or cabinet, for this is where the medium, William H. Eddy, sits, is 5 feet 9 7 8 inches high by 2 feet wide. The ceiling of the cabinet at the chimney end is 7 feet 2 inches, and 5 feet at the other end, where the roof slopes. 3 sides of the closet are lath and plaster, the fourth the solid brick wall of the chimney. There are no panels to slide, no loose boards in the floor to lift. Every inch is tight and solid. Outside the cabinet a platform as long as the width of the room, and 6 feet 7 inches wide in its widest part, is elevated 23.14 inches above the general floor level. Along its outer edge runs a balustrade door handrail, 2 feet 6 inches high, making the height from the floor of the room to the top of the rail, 4 feet 5.14 inches. The outside measurements of the L correspond with those of the circle room. For 6 months after the hall was built, there was no window in the cabinet, but one evening during the excessively hot weather of last July, the medium fainted upon coming out of the stifling place, and the window was cut through. This window, in consequence of insinuations of its possible use for the introduction of costumes and confederates, I obtained permission to effectually seal up, which I did by tacking a fine mosquito netting over the frame outside, and sealing it with wax stamped with my signet. This precaution made no difference in what occurred inside, I examined the netting every day until I left the place, about 3 weeks afterward, and found it just as I left it, with the exception that one night a violent gale and rainstorm made a slight rent, which I immediately repaired. Before this covering was put on, the window was watched from the outside, during a séance, and no Confederacy was discovered. The audience occupied the two benches and the chairs shown on the diagram. The circles being held by night, such feeble illumination as the rays comes from a kerosene lamp placed at the south side of the room, at the point indicated in the ground plan. My own post of observation is also shown. It will be remembered that beneath the circle room are the dining room, a small kitchen, and smaller buttery, all of which were illustrated in Chapter 2. The ceilings of the rooms beneath are the old lathed and plastered ceilings that have been there for many years. The new story was only added last spring, before which time the circles were held in a large sitting or reception room in the main house. The new circle room floor is supported on beams of 6x4-inch stuff running across the L, and comprises two layers of boards, one rough, laid with open joints, and the upper one of planed, but not tongued and grooved, lumber. This is the common fashion in this section of the country, as I ascertained by examining a new house in course of completion a short distance from the Eddy homestead. There is no floor below the platform floor, but the outer edge of the platform rests upon a stout timber, and its floor, laid like the rest in two layers, is nailed to transverse ribs framed into the cross timber and the outside plate. By going with a candle into the two little dark pantries opening out from the kitchen and buttery respectively, the whole carpentry of the platform and cabinet can be easily seen. One of the cuts gives a sectional view of the same. I have made two careful examinations of this matter, once with the artist, and once with the Massachusetts inventor, who was good enough to give me the follow certificating certificate, Chittenden, V.T., September 26, 1874. The undersigned, an inventor of many years' experience, a mechanician, and the grandee of 23 patents by the United States government, hereby certifies that, at the request of and in company with Mr. H. S. Olcott, he has thoroughly examined the walls, windows, ceiling and floor of William H. Eddy's cabinet, and the floor of the platform upon which it opens, and that there is no possible means by which Confederates could be introduced into the said cabinet, except through the open door, in full face of the audience, nor any place where costumes or apparatus could be stowed. Furthermore, that after witnessing numerous materializations by alleged spirits, he is perfectly satisfied that the phenomena, whatever may be their origin, are not produced by jugglery, the personation of characters by Win. H. Eddy, or chemical or mechanical device. As to their being spiritual appearances, he has not become perfectly satisfied, for his previously entertained opinions as to a future state have not been of a nature to allow him to concede the possibility of visits by the inhabitants of another world to this. 0. F. Morrill, Chelsea, Mass. A glance at the ground plan of the circle room will show that, not only can no one get to the medium, after he goes into the cabinet, by entering the door of the circle room, without detection, but no one can leave the circle to assist. The light, although very dim, is still quite sufficient to make the movements of every person in the room visible. Stress has been laid upon the fact that members of the Eddy family sit with the spectators and usually in the front row. But, in the first place, there are times when neither of the family, except William, is in the room. Secondly, they as often sit behind the last bench as on dial front one, and in the third place, it makes no difference where they sit, for no one could move a foot away from his place without being seen by everyone else in the room. Over the circle room there is nothing but an unfloored cockloft, in which a man cannot stand upright. Between the braces, the lathing and plaster of the ceiling of the room below are exposed to view, and there is no sign of trap or opening. Moreover, when I examined the place, the old cobwebs stretched from rafter to rafter showed that no one had preceded me that way, for a long time at least. I now claim that I have demonstrated the inaccessibility of the cabinet to evil disposed persons, and so eliminated one most important source of deception.